if I get through it, right? Well, friends, what's this all about? I got an image there of a cistern with water, and then I have a well accessing even deeper water. Proverbs 20, verse 5 says, "The purpose in a man's heart is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out." We're going to look at case studies of people in the Bible who get wound up about something. And the theory I'm proposing is this. If you have a situation where somebody in the Bible is a passionate, intense, wound up, it's an invitation to look deeper. There's probably more to it. We find that in real life. If somebody in our space who's normally quiet starts yelling or blowing their top, think, well, that's unusual. There must be a reason for that. So it's just an idea. It's a concept. It serves as a nice basis for a good old-fashioned open Bible study. There'll be some aha moments. For the most part, it's intended to be entertaining and thought-provoking. Here and there, you'll be challenged. First, with some announcements. In the locus of the feast, I do this. I try to weave some announcements into my sermons. First, I want to give thanks to so many people who have been working on these meals. Scrumptious food to the left of me and to the right of me. Savory things. I've wondered if I could pray for two bellies. It's so good, all these things. Then the facilities. I look around the grounds and I see so much foresight. I'm so very grateful to the team who prepared this place for our feast. I see foresight. I see love. I see hard work. I see beauty. I see order. Just like when the Queen of Sheba came to see Solomon, she saw how orderly the courtroom was, and it took her breath away. That's how I feel when I come to the feast here. You might find a little something out of order here and there. See what you can do to step up and keep it in order. But my heart is gushing with gratitude. Then there's the friendships. So many sweet and beautiful people I've met so far. I'm grateful that Yahweh has granted me the grace to cross your path. I want to talk about the night of special offerings. Here's the sign-up sheet. Yesterday, there was like four names. Look, it's almost all signed up on page one. We have some spaces left on page two, but the cutoff is Tuesday night. We might hit the end of the line there before Tuesday night, but I'm very grateful for this. Now, if I discover, I may have made a mistake in putting all those lines there. All right, so we'll see. I'm going to try to get everybody in. This is a family concert, the way I structure that. But I need stage hands. We have a small number of people who have been doing this for years. I'm hoping to recruit some help for that. All of you who are of a mind to serve, particularly youth, our blue ribbon panel of young experts back there. We need extra stage hands for the night of special offerings. And I ask you to come to me and tell me that you're willing to step up and help. We already have stage hands, typically two guys, maybe three, but we could use one or two more. And finally, the breakfast. What a scrumptious treat we had today with those pastries from Brother Chris and his family team. But I do urge you to take an egg. We're trying to get that protein in you. And so far, we haven't had any colds and sniffles yet. But I do want to urge you to take that egg because it's the first year we're trying to get some protein in there with those eggs. Okay, selected passion plays. These are selected passages from the scriptures where somebody gets passionate. These are Bible stories in which the players express intense emotion. Now, I'm only going to look at a few of them just to get the fluids going in your mind. Astonishment is one such emotion. And these are my definitions for the purpose of this presentation. Astonishment would be an unexpected development. Would lead to astonishment. Then there's screaming. This is a picture of a boy, I think, in Finland screaming. Why do people scream? Normal people scream because they just want to be heard. They'll raise their voice. There's some people who scream too much. They don't know that all that screaming wears off and it loses its punch. But if you save your, you know, you save your silver bullets, you save your screaming for cases where it's necessary, then you get heard. For some people, in some situations, screaming is all they have left. But screaming is evidence that there's something going on there that needs exploration. Then there's outrage. When the news is unexpected or horrific, and so the reaction is outrage. That's an image there of public reaction when the Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria was assassinated. That was the people were throwing vehicles over in the street. Let's see another mood that's worth talking about: rash judgment. Rash judgment. We see that on occasion in everyday life. People are harsh with their judgments. That's often evidence of hidden sin or hypocrisy. Take a look at that image there. That's an image of Eli. The scriptures say he sat at a chair by the door, and he saw Hannah praying in the house of Yahweh. Hannah was aggrieved because she wanted a baby. And she prayed, just moving her lips. She just moved her lips. Yes, Yahweh's a lip reader. He can read lips. But Eli thought she was drunk, and he confronted her on this. He says, "Why do you come here with your drunkenness? Get out." You know, don't you think he should have asked a few questions first instead of just accusing her of drunkenness? This little vignette here is a foretaste of what's to come. This rash judgment he put upon her with no investigative effort, it's evident of hidden sin and hypocrisy on his part. Because if you go deeper into the book of Samuel, you find that Eli's sons were corrupt. They were the ones who were gluttonous, thieving, immoral, not this girl. And this is a pattern you sometimes see in the world, where authorities will pick on somebody who's easy to pick on rather than the real criminals. This is a foretaste of what's to come. And then there's the case of disappointment. We'll look at least one disappointment in our overview, where there's a life-changing development caused by time and chance or sin, neglect, or betrayal. But in all these cases, you'll find there's a bit more to the story. Let's start with this easy one. Nathan confronts David about Bathsheba, 2 Samuel 12. Now, I said there's going to be a lot of reading here. At these points like this, I have to grab my Bible. I'm not going to crowbar all that into the slides. You can listen or follow along. Should be 2 Samuel 12. I don't think I'll be reading the whole thing, but I'll read enough to get the story across. Before I start reading in chapter 12, prior to this, David had stolen another man's wife. Her name was Bathsheba. Her husband was Uriah the Hittite, a top commander in the army. David stole his wife while he was away in battle, and David arranged for Uriah to be left vulnerable in battle so that he would be killed, and the wife that David stole would be all his. Now, that's a little summary, suitable for children. Chapter 12, verse 1 of 2 Samuel. And Yahweh sent Nathan unto David, and he came unto him and said unto him, "There were two men in one city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had exceeding many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing save one little ewe lamb, which he bought and nourished up, and it grew up together with him and with his children. It did eat of his own meat and drank of his own cup and lay in his bosom and was unto him as a daughter. And there came a traveler unto the rich man, and he spared to take of his own flock and of his own herd to dress for the wayfaring man that was come unto him, but took the poor man's lamb and dressed it for the man that was come to him. And David's anger was kindled against the man, and he said to Nathan, 'As Yahweh liveth, the man that hath done this thing shall surely die. And he shall restore the lamb fourfold, because he did this thing, and because he had no pity.' And Nathan said to David, 'Thou art the man.' Thus saith Yahweh Elohim of Israel, I anointed thee king over Israel, and I delivered thee out of the hand of Saul. And I gave thee thy master's house, and my master's wives unto thy bosom, and gave thee the house of Israel and of Judah. And if that had been too little, I moreover would have given unto thee such and such things. Wherefore hast thou despised the commandments of Yahweh to do evil in his sight? Thou hast killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword, and hath taken his wife to be thy wife, and hast slain him with the sword of the children of Ammon. Okay, that's his punishment. Now he's going to have all these bad things happen in his family. I just want to take a closer look. When David heard about this guy who stole the poor neighbor's lamb, he got angry. In 2 Samuel 12, verse 5, he says, as surely as Yahweh lives, the man who did this deserves to die. Rash. Blowing up. The Torah tells you exactly what the compensation should be. So he says, this man deserves to die. And then the next verse, he says, he's got to pay back fourfold. I don't see how a dead man is going to pay back fourfold, but anyway, this rage was evidence of something inside. He already had latent guilt from the sin he had committed. What he should have done under normal, sane, rational, non-guilt-ridden conditions, he should have sat down and said, okay, how does the law judge a case like this? Because it's a little tricky. Oh, thanks, Javon. Yes, I'm all set. Thank you. It's a little tricky, but there is a formula for making recompense to this guy. But he says, that guy should die. You know, he shouldn't have said that because he was perhaps setting the stage for his own judgment. We're going to talk about King Shaul in a minute, but that's just an evidence that somebody's like reeling off harsh judgments. It's possible that they have inside of them guilt that they're dealing with. That's a simple story, but that gets things moving for us. We're going to talk about David and King Shaul's executioner. We have a painting there of the death of Saul. And though we're going to begin in 2 Samuel chapter 1, the story actually begins in the last chapter of the previous book, the last few verses previous book. King Saul has been killed in battle, and he's bleeding to death in the battlefield. And it's said that he expires there. But then you go to the next book, the first chapter, 2 Samuel 1. And you get the rest of the story. And what a story it is. Okay, I won't be reading the whole thing. But I'll stop at what I believe is a good point. 2 Samuel chapter 1, starting from the beginning. Now it came to pass after the death of Shaul, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had abode 2 days in Zilkag. It came to pass on the third day that, behold, a man came out of the camp from Shaul with his clothes rent and earth upon his head. And so it was when he came to David that he fell to the earth and did obeisance. And David said unto him, from whence comest thou? And he said unto him, out of the camp of Israel I am escaped. And David said unto him, how went the matter? I pray thee, tell me. And he answered, that the people are fled from the battle, and many of the people also are fallen and dead. And Shaul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also. And David said unto the young men that told him, how knowest thou that Saul and Jonathan, his son, be dead? And the young men that told him said, as I happened by chance upon Mount Gilboa, behold, Shaul leaned upon his spear, and lo, the chariots and horsemen followed hard after him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called unto me, and I answered, here I am. And he said unto me, who art thou? And I answered him, I am an Amalekite. He said to me again, stand, I pray thee, upon me, and slay me, for anguish has come upon me, because my life is yet whole in me. So I stood upon him and slew him, because I was sure that he could not live after that he was fallen. And I took the crown that was upon his head and the bracelet that was on his arm and have brought them here unto my master. Then David took hold on his clothes and rent them, and likewise all the men that were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until even, for Shaul and for Jonathan his son, and for the people of Yahweh, and for the house of Israel, because they were fallen by the sword. And David said unto the young man that told him, Whence art thou? And he answered, I am the son of a stranger and Amalekite. And David said unto him, How wast thou not afraid to stretch forth thine hand to destroy Yahweh's anointed? And David called one of his young men and said, Go near and fall upon him. And he smote him that he died. And David said unto him, Thy blood be upon thy head, for thy mouth has testified against thee, saying, I have slain Yahweh's anointed. Now here we have two reactions from David. I remember the first time reading that, it looked kind of, ooh, is this guy a hothead? Why was there such a strong reaction? One thing is he tore his clothes, and you'll know in antiquity, people tore their clothes when they were overcome with anger or grief or outrage, many of the emotions I listed there. And then he had the guy killed right on the spot. So there's this, I'm summarizing an exchange between David and this fellow, this messenger. Because he's coming in like he's got good news, you know, like Shaul's gone. How do you know Shaul is dead? Answer, I killed him. Where are you from? I am an Amalekite. That's what sent him off. Not only did he kill Yahweh's anointed, this was an Amalekite. King Shaul was supposed to eliminate all the Amalekites. The irony, the horror. But King Shaul had been coloring out the outside the lines for a long time. But there's more. There's more. Not only was he an Amalekite. Yeah, David was hopping mad about this. But King David and King Shaul's executioner also escaped from Israel's camp. In other words, he was fighting side by side with Shaul. Shaul was recruiting in his battles Amalekites whom he should have wiped out. Now, you can ask any practicing Jews. There may be some people here who are acquainted with Jewish tradition. Every morning they get up and they recite seven memorials. If you're really practicing Jew. Now, I've checked it out. There's dozens of memorials in the Bible. Bunches of them where Yahweh says, you remember this. But there's seven that our Jewish friends remember every morning. One is the Sabbath. I think another one is to remember how Miriam was punished for rebelling against Moses. But one of them is to remember the Amalekites, the Amalekites, to blot out their name. For Yahweh will forever wage war against the Amalekites. So, if you use David's rage as a kind of a decoder ring, you go deeper and you find, yeah, there's more to it than just slaying Yahweh's anointed. This guy was an Amalekite. He shouldn't have even been on the stage. And he was even fighting in King Shaul's army. I want you to remember this point. The passionate expression in a Bible story suggests there is more to the story. We're going to look at several other scenarios like this. Let's see what the next one is. Oh, yeah, the vanity and profanity of Esau. Now, in the image there, we have an artist's rendition of Esau selling his birthright to Jacob. Esau happened to, how did it go? Esau was hungry, very hungry. And Jacob says, hey, I got some food for you. Just give me your birthright. And he did so. And there's, the old King James English doesn't give it the vein punch that there is there. I mean, yeah, it was a stew. Maybe it took some time to make, but it really comes down to a bowl of soup. One of the reasons Yahweh hated Esau is because he had no regard for the birthright. This is an illustration of the day that Jacob says, I want you, my son Esau, to make venison for me. And in the illustration, you see the mom behind the curtain listening in, and she's going to run off and have Jacob make the venison and pretend to be Esau. In Genesis 27, Isaac is tricked into blessing Jacob. And we're going to read that now. Then we're going to go back and highlight some things. Genesis 27. And it came to pass that when Isaac was old and his eyes were dim, so that he could not see, he called Esau, his eldest son, and said unto him, My son. And he said unto him, Behold, here I am. And he said, Behold, now I am old, I know not the day of my death. Now therefore take, I pray thee, thy weapons, thy quiver and thy bow, and go out to the field and take me some venison. And make me savory meat, such as I love, and bring it to me that I may eat, and my soul may bless thee before I die. And Rebekah heard when Isaac spoke to Esau, his son. And Esau went to the field to hunt for venison and bring it. And Rebekah spake unto Jacob, her son, saying, Behold, I heard thy father speak unto Esau, thy brother, saying, Bring me venison and make me savory meat that I may eat and bless thee before Yahweh, before my death. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice according to that which I command thee. Go now to the flock and fetch me from thence two good kids of the goats. Then I'll make them savory meat for thy father, such as he loveth. And thou shalt bring it to thy father that he may eat, and that he may bless thee before his death. And Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, Behold, Esau, my brother, is a hairy man, and I am a smooth man. My father peradventure will feel me, and I shall seem to him as a deceiver. And I shall bring a curse upon me, and not a blessing. And his mother said unto him, Upon me be thy curse, my son. Only obey my voice, and go fetch me them. And he went and he fetched and brought them to his mother. And his mother made savory meat such as his father loved. And Rebekah took goodly raiment of her eldest son Esau, which were with her in the house, and put them upon Jacob, her younger son. And she put the skins of the kids on the goats on his hands and upon the smooth of his neck. And she gave the savory meat and the bread which she had prepared into the hand of her son Jacob. And he came to his father and said, My father. And he said, Here am I. Who art thou, my son? And Jacob said unto his father, I am Esau, thy firstborn. I have done according to as thou hast badest me. Arise, I pray thee, sit and eat of my venison, that thy soul may bless me. Man, all these lies. And Isaac said to his son, How is it thou hast found it so quickly, my son? And he said, Because Yahweh, thy Elohim, brought it to me. And Isaac said unto Jacob, Come near, I pray thee, that I may feel thee, my son, whether thou be my very son Isaac, son Esau or not. And Jacob went near unto Isaac his father, and he felt him, and he said, The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau. And he discerned him not, because his hands were hairy and his brother's Esau's hands, so he blessed him. And he said, Art thou my very son Esau? And he said, I am. And he said, Bring it near to me, and I will eat of my son's venison, that my soul may bless thee. And he brought it near to him, and he did eat, and he brought him wine, and he drank. And his father Isaac said unto him, Come near now and kiss me, my son. And he came near and kissed him, and he smelled the smell of his raiment, and blessed him, and said, See the smell of my son, which is the smell of a field which Yahweh hath blessed. Therefore Elohim give thee of the dew of heaven, and the fatness of the earth, and plenty of corn and wine. Let people serve thee, and nations bow down to thee. Be master over thy brethren, and let thy mother's sons bow down to thee. Cursed be everyone that curseth thee, and blessed be he that blesses thee. And it came to pass, as soon as Isaac had made an end of blessing Jacob, Jacob was yet scarce gone out from the presence of Isaac, his father, that Esau, his brother, came in from his hunting. And he also had made savory meat, and brought it unto his father, and said unto his father, Let my father arise and eat of his son's venisons, that my soul may be that thy soul may bless me. And Isaac his father said unto him, Who are you? And he said, I am thy son, thy firstborn Esau. And Isaac trembled very exceedingly and said, Where is he that hath taken venison and brought it to me? And I have eaten of all before thou camest, and have blessed him. Yea, and he shall be blessed. And when Esau heard the words of his father, he cried with a great and exceeding bitter cry, and said unto his father, Bless me, even me also, O my father. And he said, Thy brother came with subtlety, and hath taken away thy blessing. And he said, Is not he rightly named Jacob? for he hath supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he hath taken away my blessing. And he said, hast thou not reserved a blessing for me? Now from here, Isaac gives him a token blessing, nowhere near the big one. We have Jacob coming unglued, trembling, and we have Esau exploding. When Esau heard his father's words, he let out a loud and bitter cry. What has happened? And I suppose what you know about the story, for the most part, is sufficient to understand it. But there's more, and I invite you to go a little deeper with me. Friends, there are three areas of life in which we flourish. I know there's probably more, but these are the main ones, especially for this presentation. There's physical prosperity, which was the birthright, the wealth that would have been transferred to Esau upon Isaac's death. That was Jacob's. That was sold for a bowl of soup. Yah's work is the blessing. How Yahweh is going to work through you and fulfill his plan through you. That's the blessing. And finally, there's the way of the family, wife and children. Let's look at number one. Esau peddled his birthright for a bowl of soup. The verdict is he failed. But there's more. I'm going to jump to number three. As far as the way of the family, Esau was ruined by marrying Hittite women. Now, we're right there in the same neighborhood. I want you to look, please, at the last verse or two of chapter 26. Yeah, the last two verses, starting in verse 34. And Esau was 40 years old when he took to wife Judith, the daughter of Beeri, the Hittite, and Bashemath, the daughter of Elon, the Hittite. Final verse. Which were a grief of mind unto Isaac and Rebekah. Esau, what a knucklehead. He married two Hittite women. And they drove Isaac and Rebekah nuts. And sometimes it's happened. Sometimes your kids enter into an ill-conceived marriage, and it's a grief of mind to you. Yeah, that's why I urge parents everywhere, get your kids ready for marriage. Teach them what to look for and what to expect. But in this third dimension of life, Esau failed there too. Well, he thought item number two, the blessing, was in the bag. Well, yeah, that's my blessing. I'm going to get that. Yeah, I'm going to get that. He thought it was in the bag. But he failed at that too. In this case, his brother, the supplanter, got in there. So poor Isaac realized that he had lost the trifecta. Across the board, every roll of the dice was a catastrophe for him. There's even more to this. This series of events triggered an important development. It's toward the end of chapter 27. In verse 42, verse 41. And Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing wherewith his father blessed him and Esau. Now Esau hates his own dad. And Esau said in his heart, the days of mourning for my father are at hand, then I will slay my brother Jacob. And these words of Esau, her elder son, were told to Rebekah, and she went and called Jacob, her younger son, and said unto him, behold, your brother Esau is touching thee, doth comfort himself, purposing to kill you. He feels good about the idea of killing you. Like, yeah, I'll make that happen. Now, therefore, my son, obey my voice, and arise, flee thou to Laban, my brother, to Haran, and tarry with him a few days until thy brother's fury turn away, until thy brother's anger turn away from thee, and he forget that which thou hast done to him. Then I will send and fetch thee from thence. Why should I be deprived also of you both in one day? And then Rebekah said to Isaac, I am weary of my life because of the daughters of Heth. That's the Hittite patriarch, Heth. That's the father of the Hittites. If Jacob take a wife of the daughters of Heth, such as these which are of the daughters of the land, what good shall my life do me? And that's what triggered Jacob to go to Laban and find his wife there. So there's much more to this story than just handing off a birthright or an inheritance. It played a pivotal role in the future of this patriarch. We're warned in Hebrews 12:14, follow peace with all men and holiness without which no man shall see Yahweh. Sorry about those common titles. Looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of Elohim, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled. Verse 16, lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. That was the last thing he had. I'm sorry. The blessing was the last thing he had because he had already sold his birthright. For you know how that afterward, when he would have inherited the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place of repentance, though he sought it carefully with tears. Okay, I'm going to spiritualize this for us. I know some of you are thinking about getting baptized or entering into covenant with Yahweh. But those of you either thinking about it or have already tasted it, once you get a glimpse of the kingdom, nothing else matters. And you're not going to sell it for a bowl of soup or for some swanky chick who flutters her eyes at you. You say, my life in Yahweh is worth way too much. I'm not going to let anything get in the way of that. And I urge that upon you. Do not be a fornicator or profane or worldly person as Esau. Let's talk about Micaiah's grim prophecy. We're going to go to 1 Kings chapter 22. Seems everybody likes this story. I think it's in Chronicles as well, but I just happened to pick the one in 1 Kings. Yeah, it's toward the end of 1 Kings. So, northern Israel and southern Judah are proposing unity. Start at verse 2. This is 1 Kings 22. And it came to pass in the third year that Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, came down to the king of Israel. And the kings of Israel said unto his servants, know ye that Ramoth and Gilead is ours, and we be still, and take it not out of the hand of the king of Syria? And he said unto Jehoshaphat, wilt thou go with me to battle to Ramoth Gilead? And Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, I am as thou art my people, as thy people, my horses as thy horses. And Jehoshaphat said unto the king of Israel, inquire, I pray thee, at the word of Yahweh today. And the king of Israel gathered the prophets together, about 400 men, and said unto them, shall I go to Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall I forbear? And they said, go up, for Yahweh shall deliver it into the hand of the king. And Jehoshaphat said, is there not here a prophet of Yahweh besides that we might inquire of him? She's got 400 prophets all saying, go for it, man. It's all yours. And the king of Israel said unto Jehoshaphat, There is yet one man, Micaiah, the son of Imlah, by whom we may inquire of Yahweh. But I hate him, for he doth not prophesy good concerning me, but evil. So I locked him up. Because he spoke the truth, right? And Jehoshaphat said, let not the king say so. And the king of Israel called an officer and said, hasten hither, Micaiah, the son of Imlah. And the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, sat each on his throne, having put on their robes in a void place in the entrance of the gate of Samaria, and all the prophets prophesied before them. So you have 400 guys parading around telling you, yeah, you're going to take Ramoth-Gilead. And Zedekiah, the son of Chenana, made him horns of iron, and he said, thus saith Yahweh, with these shalt thou push the Syrians until thou have consumed them. So now he's doing what's called dramatic prophecy. He's got some horns, he's dramatizing how he's going to push the Syrians back. And all the prophets prophesied so, saying, go up to Ramoth-Gilead and prosper, for Yahweh shall deliver it unto the king's hand. And the messenger that was gone to call Micaiah spoke unto him, saying, behold now, the words of the prophets declare good unto the king with one mouth. Let thy word, pray thee, be like the word of one of them, and speak that which is good. Okay, so butter up the king. Just go along with all those other prophets. Micaiah said, as Yahweh lives, what Yahweh saith unto me, that will I speak. So he came to the king, and the king said unto him, Micaiah, shall we go up to Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall we forbear? And he answered him, go and prosper, for Yahweh shall deliver it unto the hand of the king. And the king said unto him, how many times shall I adjure thee that thou tell me nothing but that which is true in the name of Yahweh? And he said, I saw all Israel scattered upon the hills as sheep and that have not a shepherd. And Yahweh said, these have no master. Let them return every man to his house in peace. And the king of Israel said unto Jehoshaphat, did I not tell you that he would prophesy no good concerning me, but evil? And he said, hear thou therefore the word of Yahweh. This is Micaiah speaking. I saw Yahweh sitting on his throne and all the host of heaven standing by him on his right hand and on his left. And Yahweh said, who shall persuade Ahab that he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one of the spirits said on this matter, and another said on that matter. And there came forth a spirit and stood before Yahweh and said, I will persuade him. And so Yahweh sent an evil spirit to fill the mouths of 400 false prophets. Now, when you first read this, that dynamic between Micaiah and Ahab is lost. But he blew up at him. In 1 Kings 22 verse, well, I don't know if I have the right verse. The king said unto him, how many times shall I adjure thee that you tell me nothing but that which is true in the name of Yahweh? Well, he just prophesied good. How did the king know that Micaiah was not speaking truth? He said the same thing as the other 400. The king is obviously angry at him here. How many times do I have to tell you? Speak only the truth. You have to retrofit back into the dialogue because you don't get it in the Hebrew text. Here's what he said. He said something like this. Yeah, go ahead. Ramoth-Gilead, it's all yours. Yeah, go talk. No problem. Sort of like Bill Cosby saying, yeah, right, you know. It's unbelievable. You can't trust words that are spoken like that. And that's why the king blew up. Because that was his reaction. And I think it was good that he got that reaction. I'm glad that the prophet got him to see. This is not an easy thing you're proposing to do. Micaiah's first remarks were uttered flippantly. And because of the evident rage in the king's remarks, you're forced to go back and go, well, what did Micaiah say? You look at the words. What did he say to trigger that anger from the king? It wasn't what he said. It was the way he said it. And you have to read that in there for it to make sense. But there's one other thing. An observant Bible students will tell you that when a prophet speaks, he makes it absolutely clear that he's speaking for Yahweh. You know, one of the problems I have with all these modern prophets running around in the Christian and the charismatic circles, I've never heard them say, thus saith Yahweh. So I'm not even interested. There's not even like a drop of interest in what they say. There's a bunch out in Kansas City called the House of Prayer. Maybe some of you have heard about it. I remember reading about 20 years ago, the leader, Mike Bickle, had a press conference. He said something like this. He said, we're trying to figure out why our prophets are only right 30 to 60% of the time. Well, I knew at once why they're right only 30, 60% of the time. That should be easy for anybody to figure out. They're false prophets. I mean, you know, it never crossed his mind that they were false prophets. Today, that organization is plunged in scandal. Unspeakable scandal. It's all fake over there. And I have no time for fake prophets. A real prophet will be correct, and he will say, thus saith Yahweh, or something like that. Sometimes they say, the word of Yahweh came to me. Sometimes they'll say, the angel of Yahweh came to me. In the New Testament, we have interesting language there. When Agabus the prophet came down and prophesied about Paul's persecution, He said, thus saith the Holy Spirit. Now, there's a little something here a lot of people don't know. That formula really shouldn't be, thus saith the Holy Spirit. The construct should be, thus saith the Spirit of the Holy One. And this is true across the board. You've heard of the expression Ruach HaKodesh. That means Spirit of the Holy or Spirit of the Holy One. In all these cases, the prophet is making clear that they are not his words. Even Yahshua said, the words I'm telling you, they come from my Father in heaven. The prophet must make it clear. You go back to Micaiah's remarks. I'm going to read them again. And he answered to him, go and prosper, for Yahweh shall deliver it into the hand of the king. He did not put on it the stamp of prophetic formula. And Bible scholars and students know about this. The prophet's supposed to make it obvious that the remarks are from Yahweh and not him. Because when the prophecy's ended, you're back to just talking to an ordinary person. You find him invoking the prophetic formula in verse 19. And he said, hear thou therefore the word of Yahweh. Now he's talking truth. And it was horrible. Ahab died in battle, and northern Israel was left without a king. So there had to be something in Micaiah's remarks that made the king react so vigorously. And it was that Micaiah's first utterance did not have the prophetic formula, and it was said flippantly. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, Ramoth Gilead, no problem. Yeah, go ahead. Okay, we're going to talk about Yahshua under trial. They arraigned Yahshua before Caiaphas, the high priest. And they couldn't get any witnesses to come together on any credible story. So Caiaphas says, he asked him the million-dollar question. He says, I adjure thee by the living Elohim that thou tell us whether thou be the Messiah, the son of Elohim. And in verse 64 there, we're at Matthew 26. In verse 64, here's Yahshua's answer. You have said it. Besides, I say to you, from now you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. And that was the high priest's response. When he heard those words, he went tapioca bananas. We have to take a close look at what Yahshua said to understand the rage. Verse 65, then the high priest tore his garment, saying, he has blasphemed. Why do we need any more witnesses? See, now you have heard his blasphemy. What did he say? That caused, because I look at the words, it doesn't seem all that. I've already accepted Yahshua as the Messiah, so maybe his words don't seem so striking to me. Why did the priest go nuclear? Well, notice he tore his garments. Shouldn't have done that. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But the priest reacted to Yahshua coming in the clouds. That was the thing that got him killed. That was the thing that for which Yahshua was killed. In Exodus 34, verse 5. We will never say that Yahshua is Yahweh the Father. We're not going to say that. I don't want anybody to think that. Yahweh does everything through Yahshua. Exodus 34, verse 5. Yahweh comes in the clouds. Yahweh descended in the cloud and stood with him there, Moses, and proclaimed the name of Yahweh. Oh, by the way, he said the name Yahweh twice. And Yahweh passed by before him and proclaimed, Yahweh, Yahweh, El merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth. So there you see Yahweh coming in a cloud. In Daniel 7, verse 13. Just flipping around a bit. Why is it that the pages I need stick together? Okay. 7 verse 13 of Daniel. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. In Nahum 1 verse 3, now that one I should have dog-eared because Nahum is a short book. I might have to jump to Isaiah because it's so easy. Here he is. Nahum chapter 1 verse 3. Yahweh is slow to anger and great in power and will not at all acquit the wicked. Yahweh hath his way in the whirlwind and in the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. And then finally, Isaiah 19:1. Of course, the priest knows about all this stuff. So when Yahshua says he's coming in the clouds, it just blew his mind. It blew the priest's minds. Isaiah 19:1, that's the last one we're looking up here. The burden of Egypt, behold, Yahweh rideth upon a swift cloud and shall come into Egypt, and the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence. So on and so forth. So the priest reacted to Yahshua coming in clouds. But also the priest is not allowed to tear his robe. It's in Leviticus 21, verse 10. With torn raiment, he is unqualified to serve. The priest just blew it. I didn't make you turn to Leviticus 21, 10, but it's there. The priest is not supposed to tear his garments. So now he's unqualified. Who's going to take his place? The priest just tore his garment. He's not qualified now. You don't think he's going to be moping around the temple with his clothes torn, do you? So who's taking his place? I know who's taking his place. Do you? The reaction of the priest is a tip-off to drill down deeper. He tore his clothes. He was not supposed to do that. And the wording that ticked him off was Yahshua's reference to coming in the clouds. He says, you're talking like you're Yahweh there. And they called it a blasphemy. We're going to talk about Nehemiah's gated community. Nehemiah was forced to enforce the Sabbath by force. It's in Nehemiah chapter 13. I told you this is going to be like an open Bible study. You all seem to be holding up well. Going to Nehemiah 13. Again, I do some reading, and then we rewind, like an instant replay, to take a closer look at some of the intense events going on. On the day that they read in the book of Moses in the audience of the people... I want to start in verse 15. Nehemiah 13, verse 15. In those days saw I in Judah some treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in sheaves and lading donkeys, as also wine, grapes, and figs, and all manner of burdens, which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I testified against them in the day wherein they sold victuals. And can you imagine some guy with a push cart coming down the hill there and selling stuff here on Sabbath? There dwelt men of Tyre also therein, which brought fish and all manner of ware and sold on the Sabbath unto the children of Judah and in Jerusalem. Then I contended with the nobles of Judah and said unto them, what evil thing is this that ye do and profane the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers thus, and did not our Elohim bring all this evil upon us and upon the city? Yet you bring more wrath upon Israel by profaning the Sabbath. And it came to pass that when the gates of Jerusalem began to be dark before the Sabbath, I commanded that the gates be shut in charge, that they should not be opened till after the Sabbath. And some of my servants set eye at the gates, that there should be no burden be brought in on the Sabbath day. Just three more verses. So the merchants and sellers of all kind of ware lodged without Jerusalem once or twice. Can you imagine that? He shuts the gate, and so they hang around out there so that when Sabbath's over, they can just charge right in and pick up where they left off. Then I testified against them and said unto them, why lodge ye about the wall? If you do so again, I will lay hands on you. From that time forth, they came no more on the Sabbath. And I commanded the Levites, I commanded the Levites that they should cleanse themselves and that they should come and keep the gates to sanctify the Sabbath day. So now he recruits the Levites to maintain the sealing of that gate. And then he offers a prayer to Yahweh. So I confronted the nobles of Judah. Why are you profaning the Sabbath in this evil way? And he was pretty obviously very ticked about this. Now I want you to look at the next three verses. He says, about the same time, I'm taking a chunk from there, I realized that some of the men of Judah had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. I beat some of them and pulled out their hair. But what got him to that point? Here's what's going on. I mean, Nehemiah is really wound up at this point. It's the end of the book. Nehemiah actually had an ongoing problem with corruption among the rich, the powerful, and those who should be leaders, who were bringing the Jews down. We go back to Nehemiah chapter 5, verse 1 to 13. I'm going to go back to Nehemiah 5. There is a pattern there. I want you to step back and look for it. Nehemiah chapter 5, verse 1 to 13. Then the prophets Haggai and the prophet Zechariah. I'm sorry. We're going to start at verse 3. Oh, I apologize, friends. Oh, I know what's wrong. I'm in the book of Ezra. No wonder it doesn't match. Happens to the best of us. Okay, this is gut-wrenching. And there was a great cry of the people and of their wives against their brethren, the Jews. For there were that said, we, our sons and our daughters, are many, therefore we take up corn for them that we may eat and live. Some also there were that said, we have mortgaged our lands, vineyards, and houses that we may buy corn because of the dearth. There were also that said, we have borrowed money for the king's tribute and that upon our lands and vineyards. Yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our children as their children. And lo, we bring into bondage our sons and our daughters to be servants. And some of our daughters are brought into bondage already, neither is it in our power to redeem them. For other men have our lands and our vineyards. Jews were oppressing Jews. And I was very angry when I heard their cry and these words. Then I consulted with myself, and I rebuked the nobles and the rulers. And said unto them, you exact usury, every one of his brother. And I set a great assembly against them. And I said unto them, we after our ability have redeemed our brethren, the Jews, which were sold unto the heathen. And will you even sell your brethren, or shall they be sold unto us? Then held they their peace, and found nothing to answer. I also said, it is not good that you do ought ye not to walk in the fear of our Elohim because of the reproach of the heathen, our enemies. In other words, our enemies are oppressing us. Why are you oppressing each other? I likewise and my brethren and my servants might exact of them money and corn, I pray you. Let us leave off this usury. Restore, I pray you, to them even to this day their lands, their vineyards, their olive yards, and their houses. Also, the 100th part of the money and of the corn, the wine and the oil that you exact of them. Then they said, we will restore them and will require nothing of them, so will we do as thou sayest. Then I called the priests and took an oath of them that they should do according to this promise. So the priests come in and witness this vow. I also shook my lap and said, so Elohim shake out of every man from his house and from his labor that performeth not this promise, even thus be shaken out and emptied. And all the congregation said, amen. They praised Yahweh and did what they said they were going to do. So here the problem is with the nobles and officials. with these merchants on the Sabbath. He confronted the nobles of Judah. Why are you profaning the Sabbath in this evil? In verse 20, they got this Sabbath itch. This Sabbath itch. The merchants and tradesmen with a variety of wares camped outside Jerusalem once or twice. They're camping outside the gate so that once it's sundown, the gates will open, they can swing into action with their merchandising. You know, I've learned that once I'm convicted of Sabbath and I get my employer settled down and I start to arrange my affairs so that Sabbath is being kept, the next temptation that seems to come is to use Sabbath as kind of a overflow day or like flex time. Well, we know we can't go selling things until they open the gates at sunset. Let's camp outside so that we're ready to go. And they don't understand. The whole idea of holiness is beyond them. You will be confronted with that temptation too, especially in this prosperous nation. You'll be tempted on Saturday afternoon to prepare for an event Saturday night instead of holding your peace. You'll be tempted to leave before sunset for that big concert. I remember how careful I've been, like when I was ever dating or in courtship, that if we had event in the locus of Sabbath, we made sure we never trampled on it before or after. Sabbath is not a flex time, and these merchants and tradesmen thought it was a flex time. Yeah, let's go down there and wait outside the gates. The Sabbath itch. More on this corruption. There's favoritism in Nehemiah 13, verse 4 to 5. Eliashib, the priest who had been appointed as supervisor, there you go, another leader. A supervisor of the storerooms of the temple of our Elohim, who was also a relative of Tobiah, had converted a large storage room and placed it at Tobiah's disposal. Now we're not going to take time for the whole story here, but this chapter 13 shows that Nehemiah went back to Persia to check in with the king. And when he come back, this whole chapter is what he saw. The storehouse in the temple was being occupied by some relative of the priest. And you'll see later on, I don't have time for it now, Nehemiah had to go in there and clean the whole thing out. What's this guy doing sleeping in there? He had to throw out all his personal things. Nehemiah was dealing with a lot of corruption from people who were in places of leadership. One of the sons of Jehoiada, son of Eliashib, the high priest, had married a daughter of Sanballat the Horonite. So I banished him from my presence. So now you have priestly corruption. You know, on one hand, you'll see a nation right now that's crying out for revival. But when you experience true revival, somebody has to come along and get rough. And this helps explain Nehemiah's anger. Nehemiah's growing rage was a response to the Jews slipping here and there. Those in leadership were expected to uphold the standards, but rather they took advantage. Okay, I will not be establishing doctrine here, but we're going to look at a passion play scenario, Matthew 19. I call this marriage reconsidered. You know, marriage has the possibility of making you very happy, but it also has the potential for making you unhappy, and that's why you have to be careful about it. We're going to focus on the reaction of the apostles. When Joshua was asked about marriage, divorce, and remarriage, I'm going to just quote the King James here without any comment. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore Elohim hath joined together, let no man put asunder. And a little later in the same discussion, he said, and I say unto you, whoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And if so marrieth her which is put away, doth commit adultery. Now, this was a dialogue between him and some Pharisees, but his apostles were listening in. And this was their response. When they heard that, The disciples were stunned. They just couldn't handle it. And so even though we don't have them screaming or yelling, inside, they were shell-shocked. His disciples say unto him, if the case of the man be so with his wife, it is good not to marry. You know, friends, I've been single all my life. You know that. And over the years, even if they had people tell me, or I overhear conversations where they say things like, pray to the Father and he'll send the right one to you. And they say that because some people have experienced that. But there's others who have not. But all these decades, I look back since my baptism in 1980. In fact, one of the guys who baptized me is here today. Hallelujah. But all through my walk, no one has ever said, this marriage thing is serious business. Nobody quotes Paul, who says, you better know what you're doing. You better be really careful, because this institution has enormous power to make people happy, but it also has the power to make them unhappy. And I've never seen anybody, all these years, I've never seen people give enough weight to the gravity of this decision to prepare for it, the sanctity of this institution. I'll say this. There's a lot of people debate about what this passage is about. I'll leave that to the elders to explain that. But if your theology about this is reasonable, common sense, you probably got the wrong interpretation. Right? Because they didn't think it was reasonable. Finally, Yahshua clears the temple. Just one little thing I want to point out. This will be the last thing we cover. There's no images of Yahshua in any of this. He clears out the temple in Matthew 21, verse 12 to 17. We're not going to go through the whole thing. But when he was done, I mean, he obviously was out of character there. He obviously was angry. In John 2, 18, it says, on account of this, the Jews demanded, what sign can you show us to prove your authority to do these things? Where did he get his authority from to do this? Where did it come from? Well, it came from the fact that it was his father's house. And they want to know, like, where do you get off doing this? I once went to, many years ago, I attempted to go to a Messianic Passover Seder on a Friday night. And I was stunned to find it was catered by professionals. Friday night, do you understand, friends? Friday night. And there was racks of magazines and books being sold. I walked out. And as I walked out, I thought, if this was my assembly, would I have flipped everything over? I was so grieved by that. So grieved. And at that time, YRM was not an option. It didn't exist back then. The search for a spiritual home will have some bus stops along the way that are a disappointment. But there's one thing, when you do a little research, you find there's one element that Yahshua had in place. This cleansing of the temple was a planned event. He knew he was going to do this someday. And I'll show you why. It's when he paid the temple tax. I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's in Matthew 17, 24 to 27. But he was challenged. Don't you and your boys pay that temple tax? He took Peter aside. He says, come on, let's think about this. When the kings collect taxes and tribute, do they collect it from their sons or for the subjects of the kingdom? And Peter said, they collect taxes from the subjects of the kingdom. And Yahshua said, that's right, the sons are exempt. But so that we may not offend them, go to the sea, cast a hook, and take the first fish you catch. When you open its mouth, you will find a 4-drachma coin. Take it and give it to them for my tax and yours. He didn't want to offend them. He said, yeah, the sons are exempt, but we don't want to offend them. If he hadn't paid this tax way back in Matthew 17, several chapters before, they would have nailed them at the temple. And you have to understand, authority is earned and then assigned. And you have to check off all the boxes before you have authority to move in Yahweh's direction, in his plan. If he didn't have this temple tax settled, he would have offended them when he cleansed the temple later, and they would have pushed back on him. And this reminds me of the place where Yahshua says you got to get every speck out of your eye, and you got to be perfect. You got to make sure you have a clean record before you confront people, because they will find fault with you. If you don't have every box checked off, you have to have a squeaky clean record to represent Yahweh. Okay, so I'm going to close with this. Passionate expression in a Bible story suggests there is more to the story. And then life application. When those in our space get wound up, we should seek to understand their deep waters. Now, there are people who seem to be always wound up, always yelling, picking, contentious. I'm not talking about them. They need help. They need some counseling. But when you see people in your space get wound up about something, I have learned now to say, let's find out what you're talking about. There's probably more. There may be a lot of things built up. You know that some people just accept a lot of offenses and hurts, and then they cross a tripwire and then they blow up. We should try to find out what that stuff is in people, because their souls are deep waters too. Okay, you guys have been real patient through this. I know there was a lot here, but I mean, you came a long distance, right? And just want to challenge you and get some thoughts going. Thank you for your kind attention, Brother Jose.